We have a question here.
Hi, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating. I was wondering if you guys could tell us if you could set your ideal policy for the war on cocaine specifically and like illegality of cocaine in the U.S. right now, like what would that policy be and how does that fit in with all of this that you've talked about? Thank you.
Well, I think you'd get a lot of different responses to that within the drug policy reform movement. And I want to underscore that there is a drug policy reform movement here in this country and also in Latin America. And particularly in Latin America, that wasn't the case a few years ago. With regards to coca, I think it's a no-brainer. There is absolutely no reason coca should be prohibited in international law. There's absolutely no reason that countries like Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia should not be allowed to market coca products internationally. There's no reason that Coca-Cola should not be allowed to use their coca flavoring, and of course other countries should be allowed to do the same. The amount of cocaine alkaloids in the coca leaf is minuscule. It's tiny. It's very small. So it does not pose any kind of danger when used in its natural form. I do think that there is an issue with the people who grow coca are some of the poorest people in Latin America. These are poor farmers with small plots of land, and I think we have an obligation to help those countries bring those people out of poverty, and that means comprehensive, equitable, rural economic development programs in areas like the Bolivian Chapare, along the lines of what Sanjo was saying earlier. With regards to cocaine, I think that's where it gets trickier. There certainly are people who would advocate for complete legalization of drugs across the board. My own personal opinion is that, one, drug use should not be illegal. We should not be putting cocaine users or users of any other drugs in jail. Two, I think we need to experiment with marijuana legalization so that we begin to have some body of scientific evidence to see what happens when you legalize first a drug that is much less dangerous and what we can learn from that for looking at more dangerous drugs such as cocaine and more addictive drugs such as cocaine. And I also think we need to fundamentally revamp our drug laws. This is an issue I work a lot on in Latin America. We have created a system where we put in jail primarily small-scale drug dealers, the guys and the girls and boys selling the drugs on the street corner or running drugs back and forth, or the people in the Andean countries who are transporting drugs. These people aren't making a lot of money off of it. And the day you arrest them, they are replaced by the drug trafficking organizations. Yet they go to jail, and in this country, and particularly in Latin America, which has adopted across the board in many countries harsh U.S. drug laws, they can end up with 20 years in jail. Just one example, Ecuador, which really has a very, is a minor player in the international drug trafficking networks. The maximum sentence for murder in that country is 16 years. The sentence for drug trafficking is a minimum of 12, maximum of 25 years, and it doesn't distinguish between your level of involvement in the drug trade. So you go to jails in Ecuador, and you find people who were selling drugs on the street corner, who had a judge that was in a particularly bad mood that day or was worried about getting his U.S. visa renewed, and gave him a sentence of 20 years, and he ends up in jail for longer than somebody who has committed murder. It's just ridiculous. So we need to do a major reform of our drug laws to ensure that sentences are proportionate to the crime committed. Sanjo, you probably want to add to that.
Yeah, I would just add that, the way we talk about this is difficult in the United States. Americans, we're very simple-minded people. We like simple answers, unfortunately. Black or white, yes or no. Who are the good guys? Which team do I root for? Menu A or menu B? But in fact, there's a spectrum of regulatory possibilities. It's the poverty of our political discourse that prevents us from having a meaningful discussion about this issue. For instance, the Inuit, the Eskimo, as it used to be called, have some 24 words to describe snow. Snow is important to them, right? It's life or death. And increasingly, it's disappearing. But that was the richness of their vocabulary. And yet, we hold democracy to be so valuable in this country. So much so we're going to export it and invade other countries and impose it. But we only have two words to describe democracy in this country, right? Democrat or Republican. And if you dare vote Green Party or Social Democratic or Socialist or Libertarian or whatever, you're viewed as some kind of a fringe freak or something like that. And it robs us of choices. So we are not allowed to consider the spectrum of regulatory possibilities, even in human politics, for instance. In the history of the human experience, we've had everything from totalitarian fascism on one end to anarchism on the other end, and everything in between. Every human society has found different ways to organize its culture, its economy, its politics, and yet we're not allowed to consider any of those human experiences other than these very two close points on the spectrum, Democrat or Republican, that are increasingly so close together, Kate Moss couldn't squeeze between them. And that carries over into the way we talk about drugs. Either yes or no, legal or illegal. But in fact, legalization is a word that I think is become radioactive. Drug warriors have had many decades to spin that term and define it the way they want it defined, which is anarchy. Right? When I've debated drug warriors in the past, they hold up a very simple dichotomy, false dichotomy. Either you support zero tolerance and their policy in the drug war, or you're accused, as I was accused of, wanting to sell heroin and candy machines to children. But in fact, there's a whole spectrum of regulatory possibilities for different drugs. Each drug should be treated differently. Right now we have a one-size-fits-all. It's all illegal. But, you know, and so we're going to have to experiment and find out which policies work best for each particular drug. Stimulants are a bit more problematic, but we need to find out to what extent our war on cocaine originally in the 80s helped popularize and spread a poor person's version of cocaine, crack. And to what extent did our war on crack help repopularize the poor person's crack, meth? Each time we end up with an easier to produce, more difficult to stop, more problematic, more dangerous drug. Right? And this is a lesson we should have learned from alcohol prohibition. There are many lessons we haven't learned from alcohol prohibition. Alcohol prohibition helped transform a nation of beer drinkers and wine drinkers into a nation of liquor drinkers. Put it this way, if you were a bootlegger during the alcohol prohibition, the last thing you wanted to smuggle was beer. A giant keg of beer, it's got a very low return on your investment, and you're going to run the risk of going to prison. And so, of course, you wanted the most pure form of alcohol imaginable, whether it's grain alcohol or moonshine or hard liquor. But given choices, how many of you are drinking liquor tonight? You're mostly drinking, to the extent that you're drinking any alcohol, it's beer or wine, right? But the drug warriors would say, oh, no, everything's, you know, all these super powerful drugs, people will always gravitate toward that. Yet you can, any of you can go out, if you're over 21, to a liquor store and buy grain alcohol. How many of you had tasted grain alcohol since college? Right? People don't want that stuff. You actually prefer the milder stuff. So this idea that the drug warriors try to drive into our minds is, I think it's a false one.
Just to underscore one point there, which is flexibility. One of the big complaints about the international conventions is that the U.S., with the conventions and in its policy towards Latin America, has basically pushed a one-size-fits-all policy designed in Washington. And what countries are saying is, hey, our reality may not be your reality. Uruguay is a tiny little country of 3 million people that has a really primarily urban population with solid institutions, which has a very good capability to actually create legal regulated markets for cannabis. Why can't they do it? Why should the International Drug Control Convention say that Uruguay can't do that or Colombia can't do that, et cetera? So what we really need here is a regime that allows for flexibility, that allows countries to experiment with or even states in this country, with what they think works best for them.
Okay. I'll just quickly add on, and what we could do with the billions of dollars that we invest in the prison infrastructure, that gets transferred into education, and then people make wiser decisions. I think, like you said, I mean, the how there's access to meth, these dirty, cheap, bad drugs, if people were able to get access to much more benign drugs like marijuana, they might make decisions that if they had the education to know that this is actually a healthier choice for you. It's a harm reduction model. We might not ever get rid of drugs completely, but there are safer alternatives to the worse options.
I mean, we have one last question over here in the corner for the evening.
Okay, I wanted to thank you. Very, very good presentation. And I think you presented a very good case where the coca leaf is innocuous or even a beneficial substance. However, it is true you get cocaine from the coca, and cocaine is quite a it's a substance where you can make a lot of money. and you've got the drug cartels involved in that. How can you control the growth of coca without getting the drug cartels involved and keeping it from being processed into the cocaine that can be obviously a lot worse in terms of effects on a society compared to the coca leaf?
You know, I think this is one of the most important concepts to get across about the war on drugs, and that is, why are these substances valued? Why are they worth so much? Cocaine, heroin, marijuana, all these drugs, they're very easy to produce. They're cheap to produce. And in a legal market, they cost pennies per dose. And yet they're astronomically more expensive. Why is that? A lot of it has to do with our policies of prohibition. As long as there's high demand in countries like the United States, there is an inexhaustible reservoir of poor peasant farmers and smugglers, whether they're driven by poverty or greed or to fund an insurgency or for whatever reason, they get into the drug economy because they think they'll get away with it, and most times they do. But it's the risk, right? It's counterintuitive. The more we escalate the war on drugs, the more value we build into this economy. So that you can buy a kilo of pure cocaine in Colombia for maybe $1,000 or $1,500 by the time you smuggle it to the streets of the United States in our major cities, and by the time the dealers, you know, cut it into little gram bags and dilute it with whatever garbage they cut it with, you can get $100,000 to $150,000 or even more for that exact same kilogram. Right? If you sent that same kilo by FedEx or a DHL, assuming it was legal, it would cost you maybe $100, $200 or something. But instead, we keep escalating the drug war, and the greater the risk to each trafficker along that smuggling route, the longer the potential prison sentence they might have to serve, the higher the likelihood they get caught, the greater the threat to themselves, the greater the risk premium they can charge the next person down the smuggling line. And so through the drug war, we actually create a tremendous indirect price support, if you will, for drug traffickers. And so the last people who want this drug war to end are the traffickers themselves, because without it, they're basically transporting minimally processed agricultural commodities that don't fetch a lot of money, and the drug warriors. It's a symbiotic dependency they have. They both need each other to keep their jobs and to maintain their livelihoods. But if you legalize, if you ended the drug war, you take away the risks, and suddenly it becomes like any other agricultural commodity, like aspirin or minimally processed agricultural commodity.
I'd just like to add a slightly different perspective to that, looking at it from the perspective of, if your goal is to disrupt the cocaine market, what's the best way to do that? And what we've seen, as I think Sanho pointed out earlier, is that going after the coca leaf has very little impact on the cocaine market. There's some very interesting studies that an economist named Daniel Mejia has done in Colombia. He's at the Universidad de los Andes in Bogota. And basically he does this, you know, complicated economic cost-benefit analysis and concludes that money invested in eradicating coca has almost no impact on the cocaine that is produced and ends up here. If you are going after the cocaine industry, you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck going after the criminal organizations, going after cocaine shipments, that sort of thing. And in fact, what we've seen in Bolivia is that the government has put a greater priority on trying to interdict the cocaine itself as opposed to forced eradication campaigns, although they do carry out voluntary coca eradication. So I think you have to look at, you know, where do we want to target our law enforcement efforts, and should it be the small farmers growing coca, or should it be those criminal organizations and the people within those organizations who are making the vast profits from the illicit business? And finally, I would just like to reiterate what Sanho said, which is ultimately it's demand that drives this process. The U.S. continues to be the world's largest consumer of illicit drugs. And if we really want to be serious about impacting the drug trade, we have to put a lot more money into treatment and education programs here at home, distinguishing between recreational and problematic drug use, which is another thing that relates to the question about, you know, better drug policies, and ultimately look at this as a demand-driven problem.
And with that, I wanted to conclude our presentation this evening. I want to thank our panelists, and I want to thank all of you for coming out.